The Deal Lawyer Podcast with John Andrews, powered by JMW Solicitors.
Hello and welcome to the Deal Lawyer Podcast. I'm John Andrews. Today I'm joined by Nathan Dean, who's in our commercial litigation team in Manchester. Nathan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
And today we're going to talk about the thorny subject of debt collection and what happens when customers don't pay you. So, Nathan, I'm obviously interested in this subject from the point of view of our personal bills, clearly, as a lawyer, but also when I'm acting for clients and they've got their businesses up and running quite frequently, cash flow is a big issue for them, particularly in the early days. So really what I'm quite interested in exploring with you today are the methods of encouraging people to pay promptly, particularly in the context of businesses, and the route to take if somebody decides not to pay you or can't pay you. So, as I say, quite often when I'm doing deals, business debt can be a problem. What sort of options are available if somebody's a bit tardy in coming up with the cash?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think completely avoiding late payments is not always realistic, but there is certainly ways you can minimise it. And I think there's sort of two options for that, really. The first port of call is looking at own internal sort of credit control processes and what can be done there. And there's a couple of perhaps helpful tips and advice that we can give. I think that the main point is to say that, you know, acting promptly and keeping momentum is key. The older debts are, the lower the chances of making a quick recovery. It's therefore important to have a clear credit control procedure. For example, as soon as payment is late, send a 7-day notice or 7-day demand for payment. And as soon as this period expires, that's the time then to really refer on to a more formal debt collection process. And in terms of the debt collection process and what can be done, that's really where we'd get involved. And the first step there is to issue a letter before a claim, which is a solicitor's letter, usually a demand for payment. The payment is made within a stipulated time frame, failing which further action will be taken. We can return to this step later and tips that can be taken to maximise recovery. However, if payment is not received, then probably the most common next step will be to issue proceedings at court, either in the county court or in the high court, depending on the value. The advantages of issuing proceedings at court are that the debt is frequently taken more seriously by the debtor. It is commonly known that there are limited adverse consequences until court proceedings are issued by a debtor, and sometimes letters before action or that they'll know they're a bit toothless until actually court proceedings are issued. That's when people start to take it more seriously. And also costs become alive issues for defendants or debtors once court proceedings are issued, provided the debt is over £10,000 and it's not allocated to the small claims track. Usually able to recover your legal costs you incur if you are successful, albeit that the amount and the actual ability to recover them costs is at the discretion of the courts. But generally, debtors will not want a court judgment against them, which will affect their credit rating. And also there's a range of enforcement options which claimants or creditors can take. A couple of the disadvantages to this route are that it can be costly, particularly if the debt is defended, as there will be a fair amount of legal work involved to get the matter to trial. Enforcement of the judgment is not always successful. It's important to establish at the outset that the debtor has sufficient assets to meet the value of the claim. One further option other than court proceedings is insolvency proceedings. For companies, this involves serving a winding up petition. The important points to note are that the debt must be greater than £750 in value and must be undisputed. If there's a dispute, then court proceedings route must be used. Again, one of the advantages to this is it should be taken very seriously by the debtor, because the consequences of not making payment at this stage are very severe. The company will be wound up and that'll be the end of the company if the debt isn't paid. But a disadvantage that people often have to consider, if there's any ongoing business relationships, the effect that this will have on that, because it's quite a severe and aggressive step and it may hamper them ongoing relationships.
There's quite a lot of information there, Nathan. If we go back and break that down. Sure. So the initial step would be, obviously, you do the work, you raise your invoice and you send that to your customer. Presumably, within your terms of business or on the invoice itself, it should stipulate within what time period that amount is payable. Is that right?
Absolutely, that's 100% correct. Having sort of clear terms and conditions or clear terms on the invoice will make it very helpful later down the line in recovering their debts. If they aren't there, you can sort of fill in the gaps later, but it's certainly helpful and much more straightforward and gives you a better chance of recovery if them terms and conditions are present at the outset.
So in the absence of a contractual provision providing when payment should be made or a date being specified on the invoice itself, is there an implied time period for payment of an invoice?
An implied time period is usually 30 days, but there can also be sort of implied methods of dealing for previous courses of dealing between the parties and when any payment terms that have been adhered to and adopted regularly between the parties, they can be implied.
Okay, so for example, if you granted a regular client 90 days to pay your bills, for example, as a matter of custom, that could become an implied custom then.
That's right, yeah. If that was the method that was adopted between the parties and used previously, that could be the implied rule in the dealings between the parties.
Okay. I guess following on from that, if a client is late in paying, interest is another way of encouraging a prompt payment by a customer. Again, is there any right to interest in the absence of a contractual provision that says, if you pay me late, interest will be chargeable?
Yes, there is. As you quite rightly point out, interest can be quite a persuasive tactic to get a customer to pay, and it can be something that's particularised and set out in an initial demand letter as a means of trying to encourage them to pay, because at that stage they'll realise that it's not going away, and the longer this goes on, the higher the debt will increase and the more that it will be. And you are right, there is legislation which governs this, which is the Late Payment of Commercial Debts Act, which sets out an interest rate and also fixed charges to add on to debts for recovery. These charges are, well, interest, the default rate for interest is 8% above the Bank of England base rate.
And that's quite a chunky rate then, really.
It is, yeah, particularly with interest rates being what they are at present. It's much more than it was only a few months ago. Yeah, and the standard rate for compensation on debt claims is a sliding scale. It's charged per invoice, and it ranges from £40 per invoice to £100 per invoice, depending on the value of that invoice being claimed.
So under that Act, we can charge interest at a chunky rate. There's some fixed administration costs, and presumably that's all in addition to any legal costs that might be recoverable if the debt's more than £10,000.
Absolutely right, yeah. So the interest costs and the late payment charges can be applied straight away, even at the letter before action stage. If there's a contractual right to charge legal costs, you can charge that straight away also at the letter before action stage. But even if there's not that contractual right, then once court proceedings are issued and provided the debt is above £10,000 and not allocated to the small claims track, you can add your legal costs on top of that as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a point worth making at this stage, that if debts are less than £10,000, they go into what's known as a small claims track at court, which my understanding is legal costs aren't recoverable in those circumstances, win or lose.
That's right, yeah. You'll get a small amount of fixed legal charges, but they really are small, they're less than £100. And yeah, so the legal costs that you'll be paying won't be recoverable.
Okay, and I guess in those circumstances, if you are headed for court for those smaller debts, generally speaking, you're either going to be pursuing those claims yourself or maybe using a debt collector to pursue that aspect of the claim.
Yeah, the small claims track is more slimlined or more streamlined than the normal court process, and it is very much designed to not have solicitors involved. So it probably would be one for a company to pursue themselves or to use a debt collection company.
Okay, so we've gone down the line where we've written to the client, we've sent the invoice, they've not paid. We've set a couple of chases perhaps to encourage payment and they're not forthcoming. So at that stage, we are then looking at court proceedings. And let's proceed on the basis that we're looking at larger debts, i.e. more than £10,000. How do you go about getting those claims issued?
So it will be preparing the necessary court form, so the claim form, and then drafting the particulars of claim. Particulars of claim will set out in it how the debt has arisen, whether that's through contract or services provided or otherwise. And we'll set out, the default, either the non-payment and the demands that have been made. And that will form the basis of your claim that will then be presented to the court.
Okay. And then my recollection for doing this type of work years ago is you issue the claim form, the court sends that claim form to the defendant. And they have a certain period of time to respond. And if they don't respond, what happens?
Yeah, so the defendant will, as you say, have a certain period of time to respond. If they don't respond, then you can request default judgment, which essentially means you will win your claim in default. You'll get a court judgment for the full amount, the full value of your claim, and you can then move on to enforce that judgment. The alternative is that the defendant can file a defence, at which point you'll have to deal with the defence of that claim and the certain procedural steps you'll need to take and also further considerations.
Great. And I think the point to emphasise at this stage is if a defence goes in, you're then into the full court process, which involves a number of steps. It can involve serving what used to be a list of documents, which is so disclosure. That could be a lengthy and expensive process. And then if you can't reach a settlement, you end up going to a full-blown trial.
That's absolutely right, yeah. You would go through the whole court process, so disclosure, as you say, list of documents, witness evidence, and the full-blown trial. I think one important point to note is, as well, is once you get that defence and the procedural steps that parties often miss, is you'll need to file a defence to the, or if you get a counterclaim as part of the defence, you'll need to file a defence to that counterclaim in order to, you know, prevent a default judgment being entered against yourself and sort of undermining your position.
So I guess the message that we're coming across to the listeners to this podcast is that the legal proceedings, particularly in the county court, are really should be seen as a last chance saloon, really, because of the expense and time that's involved in it.
Yeah, if you can recover the debt without having to go down the litigation route, then very much that's much the better. However, yeah, it is a last chance saloon. If there's no other options and the debtor simply won't pay, then that course of action is available to you.
Okay, so if we proceed on the basis that you've gone to court, you've either got your default judgment or you've been successful at trial, that's really only half the job, isn't it? You've then got to go about the thorny process of trying to get your money back.
Yeah, the hardest job, yeah.
The hardest job, is, yeah, you can, exactly,
you,
right.
You can often have a very difficult piece of paper.
So in terms of trying to enforce that piece of paper, which may have your original debt, some chunky interests and some legal costs involved. What are the options of enforcing that?
Well, the good news is if there are assets there or you've done your checks at the start and the debtor has got sufficient assets, the good news is there are a range of options available to you. Probably one of the most common ones is to obtain a charging order. For example, if the debtor or the business or individual owns property, you can apply to the court for a charge against that property, at which point your debt will become secured against that. Now, the charge will sit there accruing interest, and you can either, there's two options. You can either wait until that property is sold and recover from that. Alternatively, you can make a further application to try and force the sale of that asset and then recover from the sale proceeds.
Okay. And my recollection is, and tell me if I'm out of date on this, if the property that you've charged is a residential property, the courts are pretty reluctant to make an order for sale and would just say, let the charge sit there, accrue interest, and you'll get paid when it eventually gets sold. Is that still the case?
I'd say it's very fact-specific and dependent on the case, and it depends on the nature of the person living there. I'd say that'd be right if there's a young family living there. However, if there's not children involved and there is sort of sufficient equity, particularly in the property for a sale and to be discharged, all the debts to be discharged, the court will certainly make an order, or the court will be willing to make an order for it to force a sale of the property. Yeah.
Okay. And if it's a commercial property, then no issue at all. You probably will get the order for sale.
It's very much a balancing scale. The court will balance the interests of the people in the property compared to your interests as a creditor to be paid. And as you say, for a commercial property, the sliding scale is very much in your favour.
Yeah. And of course, that charging order is only worth anything if the property's got equity in. And my experience in the past is quite often that there will be a mortgage on the property. Yeah. Very often there will be prior charging orders which have been registered against the title because they owe money elsewhere. So the key thing is investigating what equity there is before you go down that route, I suppose.
That's right. And that's one of the things very difficult to do, because you can quite easily perform searches to find out what charges are on the property and see that. But it's difficult, if not impossible, to find out the equity in the property because you don't know how much debt will be owed under that charge.
Okay. And then I guess another alternative, I'm not sure how often that's used nowadays, is perhaps to instruct bailiffs or high court sheriffs to try to seize some property or assets to meet the debt.
Yep, that's absolutely an option. You can apply for a writ of control to the bailiff to pay a visit to the debtor's business or residential address, and if they can gain access and they can see goods of value, they can levy them goods and then seek to sell them, and you'll be paid from the proceeds of sale. Another option as well for debtors is something called a third party debt order, which is perhaps not as well known, but it can be quite an effective method. If you are aware of the bank details or the details of a bank where a current account is or any account is held by a debtor, you can apply to the court for a third party debt order, and the court will then issue an order against the bank which requires them to freeze any monies which are in that debtor's bank account. They'll search for any accounts held and they'll freeze the monies that are in the account up to the value of your debt which you've got a court judgment for. The debtor won't be notified of this whilst the freezing takes place, but after that's taken place, the debtor will then be notified and there'll be a final hearing to determine whether your debt should stand, basically, and the bank will pay you directly if you're successful.
Great. So that's a method of getting payment directly from a third party that owes money to your debtor. And then I guess one last method of enforcing that judgment, which can be a method of enforcement in itself, is insolvency proceedings, which I think you alluded to earlier on in the podcast.
Well, you can do insolvency proceedings at the outset, either before court proceedings or after. The advantage of doing them after is if you've got a county court or a high court judgment, the debt can't be disputed. So it limits the risk of it being chucked out of the insolvency route. So yes, the insolvency route after that could be a good option. And for example, issuing a statutory demand against an individual or winding up petition against a company. Again, this sort of ups the ante against them and makes them realise that if this debt isn't paid very promptly, that the company will be no more because it'll be wound up or an individual would face bankruptcy proceedings.
Yeah. So if we investigate the insolvency route a bit more, and as you said, the key to it is you can only go down that route if you have a judgment which can't be contested, or if you have a debt which is undisputed. And I think that's key. So if you've got an undisputed debt and you choose the insolvency route, what are the pros and cons of going along that process?
Well, the advantages is, as I say, the fact it will be taken very seriously by the debtor. I think that's a clear advantage because the repercussions are so huge. For example, it's a company being no longer able to trade, which someone may have spent years and years building up the goodwill in the business, and they face the prospect of losing that if this debt isn't paid. Or for an individual, it's bankruptcy, and they face being made bankrupt and potentially losing property or not being able to be a director or all the various other implications that come with being made bankrupt. The disadvantages of it are that there is always risk that you could be met with further litigation or an application to challenge your ability to use the insolvency procedure. So even if it's not a disputed debt, for example, if someone's got a potential counterclaim against you, they could try and apply to restrain the winding up position being presented or to set aside the statutory demand for the bankruptcy, and you could end up in further litigation and with further costs.
Again, going back years when I did a little bit of this work, if we looked at bankruptcy and wind up proceedings as two separate processes, obviously yeah. Bankruptcy being the process in relation to individuals, what used to happen was is that you would draw up a document known as a statutory demand, which is a formal demand for payment. Similar documents, I think, in relation to bankruptcy and winding up, would that be correct?
A winding up petition for a company, yeah, is what you'd draft. You can serve a statutory demand, but it's not required for a company as it is with an individual.
Okay. But if you didn't want to go to the expense of issuing the winding up petition straight away, you could test the water, I guess, to see whether there was going to be a counterclaim or a dispute by serving the statutory demand, which is used to be a relatively cheap thing to do. So it's just drafted by somebody like yourself, get served on the individual or the company. And that is a formal demand, which gives them a certain period of time to pay, which I think is different for bankruptcy and winding up. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. Yeah, statutory demand is a fairly straightforward document to prepare, which just sets out a formal demand for the debt. The period for payment is 21 days under the statutory demand. I think it is the same for both companies and individuals, but for individuals, they must apply to set it aside within 18 days if they want to challenge it. Whereas I'd say with companies, you've got to follow up with a winding up petition in any event.
Okay, I used to find that that document was a pretty effective method of focusing a debtor's mind. They look at it, that they see the mention of bankruptcy or winding up, and it used to more often than not bring them to the table and make them engage with you about the debt at the very least.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that's got to be responded to. Otherwise, it has that teeth, perhaps, that a pre-action letter might not have. Yeah. Because if it isn't responded to within a certain period of time, they'll potentially lose rights to challenge it. So as you say, it can have the effect of flushing out a dispute, and you can deal with that then, or it can certainly bring them, you know, debtors to the negotiation table.
And again, if they don't respond to that demand and you go ahead and issue a bankruptcy petition or wind up petition, it puts them very much on the back foot, doesn't it? Because the demand is prima facie evidence that they are insolvent and can't pay.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So that's the first argument that you would make to a court. If they sort of later tried to challenge it, you would say, look, they've already had the opportunity to do this and failed to do so. So as you say, it's prima facie evidence that they actually can't pay this debt.
So if it's a bankruptcy for an individual, if the order's made, essentially a trustee in bankruptcy gets appointed, takes control of all of their assets, including property they own, sells the assets, pays off any secured creditors, maybe debts owed to the revenue. Do they still take priority?
Well, I think that what you're saying is absolutely right, because in the back of your mind throughout all this, you're going to have the message of how do I get paid for this action? And another disadvantage of it is that what will come out first is the trustee and bankruptcy's fees, which will need to be factored into, you know, any assets that are available or in the pool, whether there's still going to be fees left to pay you after the trustee and bankruptcy has been paid, along with any other creditors, as you say, that may rank in priority to you, such as the revenue or anyone else.
So for bankruptcy, again, it's an effective method, provided the person you're suing has got assets and doesn't want to be made bankrupt. It will really focus their mind. And then we're winding up. Of course, once you issue the winding up petition, the repercussions for a limited company are really quite serious, because I think, again, if I recall the process correctly, petition gets issued. There is a period of time you have to wait before you can advertise the petition. But once it is advertised and it gets advertised in a formal legal publication, the banks get notification of that and they freeze all the company's accounts.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So once a petition is advertised, it will be seen by the banks and they'll freeze all the accounts, and it'll be very difficult, if not impossible, for the company to trade at that point.
Yeah. So again, if the company won't pay rather than can't pay, it's a really, really heavy but effective method to pursue.
Yeah. As with both of these, I think, as you quite rightly driving at, that the threat of it is the most effective means of being able to get a company to pay. Actually getting money from the insolvency process is more difficult, but you can just make yourself the loudest shouter of the group of creditors, essentially, and put yourself at the front of the queue by taking these sort of robust and aggressive actions.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I guess probably the most important point to emphasise from a insolvency proceeding is that even if you are the person that presents the petition, that gives you no priority. You may find there are a whole host of prior secured creditors, people got charges over properties, for example. If employees are owed money by companies, I think they're a preferential debtor. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the right process.
And then you've got all of the costs of the liquidator, which come out before you start to see any money, and any excess gets shared out pro rata between the unsecured creditors rather than you taking priority just because you issued the petition.
Yeah, you might be able to artificially put yourself at the front of the queue from the threat of it if they pay up before you actually go any further. But once it gets down the formal route, then you will fall in line with the terms of priority of credit to which you are.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, you're absolutely right. What we're really saying is all of these methods are fine, but really what you want to do is use them as a stick for payment.
Yeah, great pressure point. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and if you end up having to follow them through, there is a high risk that you're going to incur a lot of costs and not recover anything at the end of the day.
Yeah, I agree completely.
So I guess where we've got to this fairly lengthy discussion about how to get your money back is try and avoid the court process in the first place, really, Nathan. And it seems to me that the first stage in that is ensuring that you've got good, tight contractual terms in place with your customers, which cover when you're going to get paid, what you're going to do for the fee that you're charging, and what interest you're going to get, and what fees you're entitled to recover if they don't pay you on time.
Yeah, absolutely. Having a well-drafted set of terms and conditions which sets out all them things it is very helpful and will make your life much easier if things do go wrong. It's important to make sure that them terms and conditions are properly incorporated when you start out. So they need to be sent right at the very start of the matter rather than appended to any invoice, because it's often too late once that's done. They need to be incorporated right at the start of your dealings and sent in the first initial correspondence you have to make sure they are incorporated into the contract. Having them details, and then everyone will know then, you know, what the payment terms are, what services you're going to perform for them, and then when payment is due, and everyone will know if payment's not been made at the correct time, and you can take the appropriate action.
Yeah, and I think from past experience with clients, what you say is absolutely right. Ensuring that the contractual terms are incorporated into your dealings with your customers is crucial. And that's almost a whole topic in itself. What you want to avoid is a client sending their terms and conditions back, which say, you know, we'll pay you in 90 days, and there'll be an issue as to which terms and conditions apply. So we won't go down that route today, but it's just something that I think listeners to this podcast need to be aware of. So I think you're right. Get good terms and conditions in place, get them incorporated, and have good credit control. And if you find things are slipping, act sooner rather than later. Take some proper advice on it from somebody like yourself, and don't let it run for months, because the longer you let it run, the less chance there is of you getting paid.
Yeah, I think that it's human nature, isn't it? The older the debt, the more reluctant someone becomes to pay. Whereas it's dealt with promptly and you keep the momentum there, that the chances of recovery are much higher.
Absolutely. Well, look, Nathan, thanks very much for sharing your expertise with us today. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thanks very much, John. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm John Andrews. If you'd like to contact me to discuss the issues we've covered in this edition or discuss any other matters in previous podcasts, please do call me on 07768 266 036, or drop me an email, john.andrews@jmw.co.uk. Speak to you soon.
The Deal Lawyer Podcast with John Andrews. Powered by JMW Solicitors.